I love to go walking in the rain, to climb up a cliff as a bird sings. A quick little look, what's that I see? Some most peculiar, curious thing.
Welcome to Museum Theatre Musings, a podcast about the theory and practice of performing in cultural institutions. I am your host, Jo Klein. Throughout the previous episodes, I keep bringing everything back to IMTAL, which, if you're just joining us, stands for the International Museum Theatre Alliance. It's a marvellous organisation supporting practitioners in the museum theatre industry, with branches in the Americas, Europe, and, as I am broadcasting from, the Asia Pacific. So today, I'm very excited to welcome my first European guest, Angela Fenninger, who is joining us all the way from Germany. Angela has her own agency called the Museum Theater Events, has taught courses in costume to live interpretation, and can be found creating theatrical experiences at a huge range of cultural and heritage sites across Germany. Angela, I'm so excited that you're joining us today for the podcast because you're my first European guest. So welcome.
Well, thank you for inviting me. And of course, I'm very honoured to be the first to be invited to this podcast.
Now, I also have an invested interest here because you're actually from Germany. And when we sort of had an initial chat, I discovered that you lived quite close to Mannheim, which is a place I went to school when I was in primary school. So my parents worked overseas in Europe quite a bit. And at one point we were in Germany for a few months, and I went to a school near you called the Petzalatzi-Schule. So it's nice to find a little connection there, which is very exciting. So maybe you could tell us a little bit about where you are in Germany.
Yes, I'm based in the southwest of Germany, in the Palatinate, which is a region that's bordering on France, on Alsace. So we're very close to France. And some people might know that region in the southwest because a lot of, like American colleagues perhaps, a lot of immigrants move from that region to especially America, where you still have German-speaking communities, especially in Pennsylvania, that speak Pennsylvania Dutch, so that's where they are from. And my hometown here is Speyer, which is a weird name. And it's an ancient city that's was founded by the Romans, and we've got a lot of old buildings here. So it's on the Rhine, rather pretty, and not too far from Frankfurt.
I noticed your work because you're very, very active on Museum Theatre Facebook, if I would call it that, because we like to share all the things that we're doing. And you're always doing such interesting things, and may I say, always impeccably dressed in historical costume. So I thought what your practice was looked very, very fascinating. And the other thing is, I didn't really know much about what the museum theatre industry was like in Germany. So I'm going to start off by asking you to tell us your origin story with museum theatre, how you discovered it, whether you had any specific training. Please tell us.
Well, I got into this by a number of accidents, I believe, because it's not a, I'll put this in inverted commas, please do hear them, it's not a proper job in Germany, so it's not something you'd come across and that is a profession that people could recommend or you could train on.
I'd say it's probably not really considered a proper job in Australia either. So it's one of those things that you can fall into, and sometimes you can get a position at a heritage site, but there'd be very few people who would say that they were museum theatre practitioners as a proper job.
Yes, that seems to be a similarity in many, across many countries, to be honest. So yes, I started out with an interest in theatre. I've been involved in theatre groups and drama, all manner of stuff, improv formats, ever since I was a student in the 1990s. And I got involved as a student with a troupe, and they did costumed historical guided tours in the city I was studying, which is Regensburg in Bavaria. And they were one of the first companies, I believe, in Germany who did that sort of thing, like commercially, to dress up for guided tours and have certain themes that would be set in the past. So we'd do quacks and doctors as a theme, or crime and punishment. It's pretty much the usual things that nowadays everyone has in their repertoire. But back in the day, in like 1998, 1999, this was still rather modern where I live. So I got on their group as a performer, and I really enjoyed dressing up and, you know, guiding tourists or locals around their familiar places, telling these stories in a dramatic fashion. And that branched out into being a performer for murder mysteries. So, like, we in Germany, we call them criminal dinners, sort of crime dinner. Yeah, that's the
common. We have
term.
Them in Australia too. I think it's yet again another phenomena that you see. And I'm very interested to hear that you have a background in improv, because that's something that keeps coming up as museum theatre. Because if you're portraying a character, you really need to be able to respond very quickly to any questions. If you're showing people around a site, you really have to have a really broad knowledge and just be able to jump in there. So I think if I was talking about skills that museum theatre practitioners have, I'd say that improv is probably quite an important one.
I agree. I think you really have to be able to think in your feet and respond quickly to any manner of visitor question, especially if you do first person. If you're not, you know, in a non-scripted environment, you'd have to improvise pretty much all the time. And it mustn't freak you out, otherwise that job isn't going to be much fun for anyone. So yes, from that criminal dinner thing and guided tours, I developed an interest in the formats per se, but I wasn't thinking of doing this for a site or an historical place. But then I attended a course at the Federal Academy of Cultural Education. It's a German institution where they train cultural managers in different genres. They have a literature thing and a museum section and a performance arts section where you can get professional training courses. And I enrolled for one, which was a museum education one. And that was 2010 or 11. And one of the modules that was offered there was museum theatre. And that was the first time I actually encountered the term per se and met somebody who did this as a job for a living. And the guy who taught the class, he was working at a state museum that was telling the story of the German Federal Republic, especially post-war decades, the 1950s, 60s, even end of war, 1940s. And to me, this was fascinating. So I got chatting to the guy and we sort of exchanged numbers and stayed in touch loosely. And it really inspired me to be able to combine, you know, my love of acting and improvising with something more useful, which is obviously communicating cultural knowledge.
I'm just so excited that there was a module called Museum Theatre. That's incredible. I find a lot of people, their background in training and practice is quite cobbled together. So people come from different areas. But it's really interesting that there are these opportunities in Germany to study sort of genres. So if you're working in a cultural institution that was literary focused, that you have an opportunity to be very specific in your training, and the same in heritage. So that's quite amazing to me.
Mind you, that was a one-off thing. It's not something that anyone can enroll on nowadays. Because I was attending this general museum education thing, and this was one module out of, I think, five. And the themes of the museum education course, they keep changing every year. I'm not sure they're offering it on a regular basis. Funnily enough, like many years after I attended the course, I was a teacher in one of these classes and did a museum theatre course myself at the same academy, which was pre-COVID. I did this class, but it's not a regular feature that anyone can attend all the time.
Okay, I'm just going to do a little segue here. So when you became a teacher and you taught a module about museum theatre, what sort of things did you cover? What did you consider to be important for the students who are looking to focus on that as an applied performance aspect?
I focus very much on how to build a first-person interpretation and the aspects you'd have to explore to really form a character that's well-rounded and that can improvise and talk about his or her time. Very much based on the literature that I suppose many of the listeners are familiar with, that you'd find in museum theatre, like Stacey Roth or Joyce Tierra, the books where they give you a guideline on how to flesh out a character. So that's what I did, and to a certain extent, and also improvising practice of how to respond quickly and take the impulse and make something useful out of it. It was a mixture, it was fun. And the students, well, students, I'm saying, people as old as I am, obviously, it's very much on peer-to-peer thing. They came up with very original ideas, which I profited from probably more than the other way around.
I love that. I love it when it can, teaching can be such a two-way street. That's fantastic. So if I, so you mentioned that you'd worked in different theatre companies. At what point did you sort of say, oh, look, I'm doing museum theatre, or introduce yourself to somebody and say, I am actually a museum theatre performer? When did you, that sort of click that that's what you did now?
Hard to say. There isn't a certain time I can recall. To a certain extent, I still don't do it because I'd need more time. When I meet someone very briefly, very hard push to say I do museum theatre, because I know full well that after I say that, a lengthy explanation has to follow. So
we need
I decided on the spot whether...
we can give people when we introduce ourselves. just read.
Oh, God, yeah. So you decide whether it's worth the bother. No, but after that, I finished the course I was talking about. I went on a holiday, and this was the pivotal moment. So that's where I went on a holiday to northern Germany, a completely unrelated story, but it was raining all the time. The entire holiday was a complete mess weather-wise. And I was in Bremen, and it was pissing it down. And I was hiding from the rain in the doorway. And there was a guy with a halberd in the doorway, dressed up as a 16th century person, in his nice manner. Do come in, like a performer. Oh, fuck yeah, I'm going in. It's pelting. So I went in there, get away from the rain. And of course, it was curious too. And then I ended up in a lovely place called Geschichtenhaus. And it's an institution in Bremen, in northern Germany. And that's a very old townhouse. And on three or four stories, they have performers show scenes from the city's history. It's like a museum without any original object. It's just stage sets and performers moving in them, and they have the highlight of certain scenes, like, I don't know, being beleaguered, besieged by the Swedes in the 30 Years' War, and then about the Hansa trade and all the offices and the stuff they would trade and the exotic goods and all that, or a famous murderer who's in Bremen, everyone knows her because she poisoned so many people, and all manner of stuff. And it was really nicely done. It wasn't professionally performed in terms of, like, technically it wasn't flawless, but it was really, really heartwarming and wonderfully done. So I got the bug when I came in out of that place. I thought, oh God, this is what I want to do.
And that's interesting, because for people who don't speak German, Geschichte can mean stories or history. So
yeah, I wrote an article about this experience in the Insights magazine, the Intel members magazine, which I'm sure we'll talk about later. Mm-hmm. And I think the article was called A House Full of Stories. Anyway, so this set me on my path, this experience, which is weird. You know, chance experience set me on my path. And then I got all my literature together. So I was really intrigued. I bought all the books about museum theatre, read many articles, and came across some authors that I still like to refer to whenever I'm looking for guidance. And in some cases, I was bold as brass and just wrote them an email to say, oh, I'm really interested in this field. Can you give me some advice? Or can you give me a lead where to start? So that was quite an exciting time around 2012. And then I did my first own production for the museum in my hometown, which is the Historical Museum of the Palatinate. And I approached them to say, I'd like to perform in the depot, which is normally closed to visitors, closed to the public, where they store all their stuff. And I went in there with a group of improvisational actors, like professional improv people. And I wasn't performing myself in that instance, but we sort of took the idea to lead guests as a group that would be obviously led by a guide, so they couldn't stray off and touch everything, through this depot where all the things are stored, and collect people's memories from the group of certain objects that they saw. And this was a depot that would cover most of the 19th, 20th centuries. So they would recognize, oh, we had a bathtub like that. Oh, I remember the fittings that were in the hat shop, and they dismantled it in the 60s, but, you know, furniture's here. And they would share their personal stories, and the improv actors would tell these impulses and put them into little scenes. And that was great fun, because it was completely unpredictable, and it happened in a space where you wouldn't expect it at all.
Was that the first time the museum had that kind of performance? Were you sort of, you know, you approached them and they went, oh, we haven't done this before, let's have a go? Or did they have a history of that already?
No, I pretty much twisted their arm into doing it.
You've got to apply pressure to get people to see how fantastic museum theatre actually is. Yes. Was it something that you followed up with other performances after that?
Yes, so that was a one-off thing. And after that, they started a special exhibition about an historical topic, about how the region where I live, the Palatinate, was for a while ruled by Bavarians, strangely enough, after Napoleon, la-di-da. And because I'm Bavarian born and bred, I said, oh, wouldn't it be nice to have theatrical scenes in there? I can do my own accent, which is perfect for the occasion. I've got people can join me, have the Palatinate accent, and we can do a setting that is early 19th century when these things happen. So I performed on the exhibition floor for the first time. That would have been, I think, 2012 or 13. And that set off a lengthy cooperation that still continues off and on. I'm not always doing stuff for them. You know, sometimes there's a year or two where nothing happens and then stuff pops up again.
Well, that sounds fascinating. That it's really nice to see that you sort of started this relationship with the museum. So as I said, I don't really know much about the museum theatre scene in Germany, but there's a long and very interesting history with relationships with other countries, as you mentioned, areas being invaded by other cultural groups and connections with neighbouring countries. What things are most commonly interpreted in museum theatre in Germany?
We have perhaps certain eras that are more common than others. I'm just thinking if there is such a thing as a theme. I might also have to include performances that I personally wouldn't see as museum theatre show, but still have that quality to them. For instance, we have quite a lively large scene of reenactment groups that would come to a museum or open air site and perhaps stay there for a weekend or do program for a special exhibit that's on, say about medieval time. You'd have a group of knights doing sword fighting or whatever. So the living history aspect is quite strong here. And if you want to look at the most commonly interpreted eras or themes, especially in the southwest where I live, it would certainly be medieval stuff, which I'm not into at all. For some reason, I'm sort of saturated with that topic, and there's a lot of people who do it a lot better than I ever could. So rather than trying to keep myself out and do it properly, which obviously is costly too, I step aside and leave it to those people who I know will be great. I often have this theory that different countries, different cultures have their favorite eras, which they consider their golden era. Like in Germany, it's very much to do with Staufen, Hohenstaufen history, which is like 12th, 13th century stuff. We see a lot of that, which for many people was an important time for the German psyche for some reason. Also heavily romanticized later in the 19th century, harking back to that time. So it's very, very much present in the German psyche, is medieval stuff. But if you look to other countries, you'd find like the Dutch colleagues, they have a lot of 17th century going on. For them is the golden age of colonialism and, the Netherlands being huge empire. In Germany, no one does 17th century because 30 Years' War was on. And it's very few people who focus on that era. You don't see it much. So it's interesting to see how different colleagues highlight different eras because it's to do with their national history and where the important bits happened, as it were.
That's incredibly interesting to me because obviously Australia has a very short colonial history compared to any other country. So traditionally, you wouldn't portray Aboriginal history if you're not Aboriginal, which means we're quite limited if we're from a European background in terms of what we would interpret. So there's a lot more intensive interpretation of certain eras, but we don't have that medieval period. It's interesting to look at particular gaps in the areas. But also, I suppose my question to you would be, because you're portraying museum theatre in Germany, how is World War II handled? Is that an era that is not so much interpreted in terms of museum theatre, or is it handled in a certain way?
You're right. It's not heavily interpreted. It's not done very often because it's a sensitive issue, obviously. Mm-hmm. Well, there's various aspects coming into this. For one, it's not very long ago, so there's always a chance you might have eyewitnesses or children of witnesses who actually lived through that era in the audience, which is always a sensitive thing because it's a painful history and obviously very unpleasant. And also Germany, as having been the aggressor, is very sort of this whole guilt thing going on, rightly so. So we're very aware, I think all performers are very aware of the ideological implications of the whole thing. You know, it has to be handled very sensitively. Otherwise, you might run the risk of being seen as someone who thinks these were obviously desirable developments. I mean, there's Germany has a problem with right-wing politics at the moment. It's always been lingering, and at the moment there's a surge of right-wing parties, you know, being voted into office and all that. So it's quite a painful thing. So if you interpret that era, you always have a corresponding thing to the present time as well. And you have to be super aware of that. So not many people actually handle this. It's like a hot iron. So, oh my God, I'm quite aware of the risk it is involved in the Second World War interpretation. So I hardly ever do anything that's set in that time. Or if I did, I'd probably do a civilian thing that's unrelated to the war, dealing with other topics that are set in the 1940s. There is
it's handled a lot in film and television, but you know it is quite challenging for museum theatre performer. But I suppose the interesting thing is in England, there are so many performances relating to that time period. In fact, I'd say when I've been to England to go and research museum theatre, so I'd say the majority of the performances I saw were set during World War II.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's a whole different approach to the entire thing. And I suppose it really all comes and goes with the fact of whether you're an aggressor or defender in the war setting. I think in the British cultural context and for the British psyche, not that I know a lot about it, but I've spent a lot of time in Britain now, a lot of my friends are British. I think that whole era is associated with a whole set of different things and different experiences. Of course, most of them painful and bad, but also that blitz spirit of a nation, you know, holding together and keeping up morale and all that. There's certain aspects that are sort of positively connected to the whole story. In Germany, it's just destruction, just, you know, suffering and horrible things. So very few performers do that. There's one group, and it's not even a fully formed group. It's a number of people who keep meeting in different constellations at open air museum sites throughout Germany. You do the immediate post-war setting, like 1945, 1946, when the war is just over, and say American or British troops come in, and that time when it was still fresh and they were setting up, you know, the Allies would set up their own administrations and find Nazis and that sort of thing. So it's not a war setting per se, but it's very close, and it very much portrays this, you know, the upheaval and the spirit of the time. And they do that really well. And they would take over the entire museum villages and live in the houses for like 3 or 4 days and set up their own radio station, their own telephone connections between houses. So it's incredibly detailed, and print their own newspaper and that sort of thing.
I love that attention to detail. You're building a character.
Yeah, totally. Very dedicated performers, complete immersion into detail. So that's an interesting show if ever you get to see one.
Oh, I certainly hope so. But it sort of makes me think about the pictures I've seen of you working as an interpreter. And you're always impeccably costumed. You really, you look like there's no historical anachronisms that I can see. So I'm always looking that you have really committed to the visual aspect of the performance. What is your favourite character? So you talked a little bit about different eras that you like to play, but do you have a certain character that you find often dominates when you're developing shows for museums?
Actually, I really don't know if I have one. It feels like the favorite character is always the one I'm just working on, because I'm so immersed in doing research and finding out about them that I sort of tend to forget all the others that I did previously.
Do you ever play real people, or are you more likely to create sort of compilation character who is made up of different parts of people who lived in the time period?
Probably half and half, to be honest. I do a lot of like invented characters that are, of course, you know, plausible and rooted in that time. But sometimes it's also real people, especially if it's an exhibit about someone, you know, who's featuring in the exhibit. And then you'd take that character and really go into their biography.
Is a particular character that we might have heard of, a sort of real person, or that you could tell us about that you have played in the past?
One thing springs to mind that I did for a museum program in 2021 or 20 was COVID time. I remember all the audience wearing masks. I did various scenes in an exhibit about conscience, and it was to do with how can I put this? a Lutheran jubilee that was going on in Germany. And so it was all about conscience and what's right, what's wrong. And a lot of people were portrayed in that exhibit. And I was playing various characters. And one of them was Olympe de Gouges, a French author during the time of the French Revolution. And she was writing a proclamation of like human rights or women's rights rather at that time. And she was very active in the literary scene and quite a, you know, a wild biography, moving from the country to the city and with a child and now divorced and, you know, quite an interesting person. And because of the activities that she went very public with, all the writings and putting up, you know, posters and all manner of things in a very dangerous environment of the French Revolution, where whoever's the prosecutor, whoever's the victim could change in an instant because everything was so volatile. She got imprisoned and then she got beheaded, actually, and she got executed. And I was really fascinated by this character and by playing her, because I chose, there was a section in the museum, which was an old cloister. So the museum's set in a church and an ex-monastery, and the cloister area is part of the exhibit, and it's got these lovely vaults and it's a very special atmosphere. And it was winter time when the show was on. It was freezing out there. So the exhibition floor itself was heated. It was nice and snug. But the cloisters, where people wouldn't linger normally, were freezing. And we did a prison scene in that setting. So it's her last night before she knows she'll be executed. She writes letters to her son and all that. And that was, that got me myself crying, even though I sort of, I wrote the script and it wasn't a surprise. But it was, I found it very touching to portray that, the particular point in her life. So that springs to mind.
Because you're a freelance museum theatre performer, it means that you're constantly working with different people and different organisations. And there are a lot of elements to building shows. So I'm thinking about sourcing costumes, building props, writing scripts, and then, of course, advertising and branding and administration. What would a typical week look like for you as a museum theatre practitioner?
Well, actually, a typical week is probably far less glamorous than people think. I keep posting pictures of, I've got a show here, I've got a show there, but that's just the tip of the iceberg. Most of the time, I'm sat in an office. I've hired an office space, to be honest, in a co-working community, because I'm, after that long COVID phase and working from home all the time, I can't work from home anymore. It's just not on. So now I leave the house to go to my co-working space. And most of the time it's really about doing research, finding literature about the topics I'm working the scripts on. Yes, it's doing research, it's writing, but it's not just creative stuff. It's also a lot of admin, writing quotes for people who are interested in booking a performance, scheduling phone sessions and all manner of things. And tax is taking up a lot of my time, to be honest, more than I wish it would. So it's not really that glamorous aspect so much at all. But it's interesting because no week is the same. And I have a lot of like meetings elsewhere in the historic site, for instance. So because I'm not only performing, I'm also doing scripting for other performers. So I go somewhere and, you know, help establish a scene by directing it. Or I do just scripting for, say, audio guides when there's a special exhibit on and they want a dramatized audio guide. It's just writing for that instance. Or at the moment, I'm helping with the establishment of a children's museum within a monastery. So it's also looking at building sites and rooms and describing what's to be done for the legal tendering procedure. So it's quite a mixed bag of stuff that I'm doing throughout a week, which is nice. So the cherry on top is if I actually get to dress up, go out and perform myself, which is perhaps 10% of the time of that.
And you mentioned that it's not really a huge scene in Germany, which means perhaps not as many opportunities to collaborate with colleagues. Where do you find your inspiration for your practice?
It's very much by looking abroad, to be honest, because a lot of the good or best practice that I describe as such can be found elsewhere. It's always an inspiration to look to what the colleagues are doing in the UK, for instance, or in America, or Australia for that matter, Scandinavia. It's got a very active scene too. I think IMTAL helped me a lot to sort of stay on the ball, which is an organisation where museum theatre people can cooperate, find each other and see what everyone's up to. Because you get a lot of, well, more professional or more imaginative approaches to things when you look what other people are doing, and rather than sort of keep copying your own preferences.
So one of the advantages of being part of the International Museum Theatre Alliance is that we have connections with colleagues on different continents and different countries. And you mentioned, because there is that really small scene in Germany, that you've developed these connections in places like the UK and that you've even volunteered abroad. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes, definitely. So IMTAL is a great enabler when it comes to professional networking, it really has to be said. And I've been a member since 2015 and was chairperson for a number of years as well for the European section. So you get to meet people who do similar work and you get to, you know, have a lively exchange with them and you can visit, which is great. So I took the opportunity some years ago to spend a week at Historic Royal Palaces, where I could shadow Chris Gidlow, who was also on the IMTAL board for a long time, and, you know, watching the interpretive work that they used to do at, especially Hampton Court Palace.
Ah, see, I actually did some research there as well. I went and met with Mark Wallace and pretty much did some research while looking
at it. It's a wonderful place, yes, and very, very dedicated, talented performers. The Past Pleasures people were fantastic, and I learned a lot from just, you know, watching them, shadowing them, and see different approaches. Of course, pre-COVID was another world, but still, you know, the principle of the matter, it stays with you. And I also sort of elbowed my way into spending a few days at the Tenement Museum in New York.
Yes, also been there too, because when you mentioned before about this, the House of Stories, I immediately thought of Tenement Museum in New York, because just for people who are not familiar with it, it's an old brownstone in New York, and it's been cast back into an era in the early 20th century, or I think it's got different time periods, but it's really about the immigrant experience. So people who came to New York from different countries and lived really, really poor lives. They really didn't have much and it was very crowded, but you get to hear the stories from below, basically the stories of people who've come to make their life and their future in New York. So I thought of that immediately. And so you went to the Royal Museums in the UK, and you said you went and volunteered, so you obviously observed. Did you get to participate in any way?
Well, not while I was observing, but in a different at a different time, I got to participate in an event in England that was commemorating the 300th anniversary of the House of Hanover inheriting the English crown. So obviously Germans would come to Britain and claim their inheritance, as it were. A very unlikely inheritance at the time. So I was part of the group of Germans who were invited to come and portray the German court as it moved to London. And that was a lovely program in 2014 in Hampton Court as well. And it's still very, very memorable to me. So very impressed me very much, because it was on a very grand scale. And obviously costumes were fabulous. And, you know, it really had the look and feel of a great, great experience altogether. So that was fantastic. And the sort of quality we don't easily get over here where I live, because all the programming that's being done here, or most of the programming, is very small scale. There's never much money being invested in the thing. So German museums tend to be a bit more wary of spending when it comes to live interpretation.
I think that's probably a quality shared by museums all over the world at the moment. It's very frustrating that the thing that can often inspire people to connect with the stories of the past is often the first thing to go when times are a bit tight in terms of...
It is. It's a shame. And it's often, I mean, the money's obviously there. Like, you know, it's being spent on technical stuff and have the latest app and this and that and the next thing. So it's not like they're poor, but they just don't focus on the live and
allocation of resources, I think. Exactly. We have to always make, museum theatre practitioners always have to make a case for what we do. But you also mentioned that, and this is something we have seen in some places, where performers are on staff. So you mentioned there are some examples in Germany where there are performers who actually work for the museum and that's their role.
Yeah, there's a few houses, but really just a few and far between. for instance, at Open Air Museum Hessen Park near Frankfurt. They have their own museum theatre section, as it were, and they do productions like year-round, small scale, sometimes larger scale, depending on, you know, what the focus is. But they have people who keep performing there. And I mean, they've got a few on staff. Some of them aren't trained performers, but they work at the museum and they participate in the shows, even though they have other functions elsewhere. They also use a lot of freelancers. I was performing for them too on various occasions to complete the ranks of the performers. So this is a very much an established thing, which is quite rare in Germany. There's also Open Air Museum Kiekeberg near Hamburg. They have performers who keep appearing and they do different time settings as well, and also post-war setting, which is quite rare. So it's worth going, if you're in Hamburg, it's worth going out to see their work. And there's a museum in the south near Stuttgart, which is called Beuren. Also an open air museum where I've been active for the last 2 years. And we've established museum theatre as a, you know, a standard feature there when they're open during the seasonal opening times. However, the ensemble, the performers there are all volunteers, which is the case in some institutions that offer things regularly. It's often based on volunteer labour. Otherwise, it wouldn't work, not on that scale. But at least it's, you know, a fixed feature and not just a one-off thing on UNESCO Day and never to be seen again, which happens a lot. So very often we're just, performance is just ornamental for special occasions and then it disappears. That very often happens.
Well, that probably just about wraps up our time discussing the very interesting things happening in Germany, but also that really good insight into Europe as a whole. So how museum theatre is perhaps different in Europe compared to America or Asia Pacific. Angela, thank you so much for joining us. It has been a real pleasure to talk to you in person and to follow up on some of the fantastically interesting projects that you're working on. So thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
The theme music for this episode is the title song from These Curious Things, a piece of museum theatre written by Michael Mills of Heaps Good Productions in Adelaide, Australia, and performed by Gemma Dandy and Michael Mills.